racing around us, overwhelmed forces of darkness prevail. Still in the fight, see advancing before us, red flag of liberty that yet shall prevail. Then all of you workers fighting.
And welcome to Here We Stand. This is Kevin Annett back again, November 5th, 2017. Coming up this week, 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. Now, folks, we need to look at our history, reclaim our memory, which has been lost. Memory of the great liberating events of human history. Yes, they might have been corrupted and defeated, but that's our responsibility to reclaim that heritage and live it again and do even better this time. We're here every Sunday to keep hope alive and to arm you with what you need to reclaim your lives, your minds, and your world. Write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. And today we're going to do a very interesting remembrance. We have a clip of a series of interviews, oral histories really, of libertarians and anarchists who have fought for many years to do exactly that, to reclaim themselves and their world in the face of a corporate dictatorship. We're going to hear from them. It was a series of interviews done about 20 years ago now, but still very relevant to today. Before we start, though, I wanted to remind folks, November 5th is Guy Fawkes Day. Now, the fallacy of the Guy Fawkes image, you must know, if any of you have seen that film V for Vendetta, that Guy Fawkes is held up in that film as a symbol of rebellion against an corrupt established order. Well, don't forget now, this is all a manipulation, because Guy Fawkes was actually the fellow who tried to blow up the English Parliament and King James in the year 1603. Guy Fawkes was a Jesuit agent. He was sent into England by the Vatican to try to blow up King James because he had just brought in this thing called the King James Bible, which challenged the authority of Rome and gave the people the Bible in their own hands, which was a burning offense. The Catholic Church used to routinely burn people for owning a Bible. And so Guy Fawkes went there to try to end it. Now, why would Guy Fawkes be held up as an image in Hollywood as a rebel? Well, it's an interesting point that, and somebody did a survey of the films over the last 30 to 35 years in Hollywood, whenever a clergyman is portrayed in a film, 92% of the time that clergy is a Roman Catholic priest, even though Catholics are only 23% of the U.S. population. Now, could that be due to the fact that and this is interesting. When you look at the five or six major Hollywood studios, 20th Century Fox, Paramount, Sony Pictures, Universal Studios, Walt Disney, and Warner Brothers, they're all run by this thing called the Motion Picture Association of America. Well, guess who's the CEO of that association? Chris Dodd, a politician for the Democrats, who graduated from Georgetown Jesuit College, has been a lifelong Roman Catholic, a member of Opus Dei, and active participant in the Roman Catholic Church. Now, in other words, the Vatican has a direct hand in Hollywood, as we've known for a long time. But that Guy Fawkes image is yet another example of that. And it's something to keep in mind because, and this is show is going out to a number of remembered friends today. One of them is my buddy Nat in Harlem, who I work with whenever I'm in New York. Nat's interviewed me on his program on Manhattan Neighborhood Network TV quite often. But Nat said a really interesting thing to me 2 years ago when I was down with him. We're having a meal down on the Lower East Side. He said, you know, growing up in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s, you could take the smartest young kid from today, the one who considers themselves the most politically astute, put him back in the 60s, and they'd be considered to be a moron, have no awareness of the world or politics or just basic community organizing skills. Now, that to me is a sign of our general dumbing down. And the reason people are dumbed down is they don't remember their past. And having a long memory is one of the most radical things we can do. And that's one of the purposes of today's show, to recover some of that memory. Because let's face it, folks, you look at any crime today, any injustice, and right behind it is the profit motive. You know, we keep encountering this in our separate lives all the time. The beauty and the glory given to us as a human being is continually robbed from us by the system. And it's this stupid profit motive that has everybody running after a buck and exploiting and oppressing each other for that buck. In other words, the basic reality. We live in a criminal system where there is no rule of law. There's no rule of law except one law, the law of greed. And greed's evil twins, violence and lies. And that profane trinity is responsible for so many of the crimes today. But what we realize is that we have it in our hands to create something different. Not greed, but cooperation. Not lies, but the truth. Not violence, but peace and equality in our world. Every one of us has the capacity to create that. And over the last number of years, as we've proven, the system is coming down. It's not only coming down in the world, but in our own minds. We have stood down the Vatican and the Crown of England and the corporatocracy through our own actions. Go to itccs.org, go to the Easter 2014 proclamation that disestablished these criminal bodies. And look at their actions today. You'll see how they are on the defensive. They have their backs to the wall. Just look at the extent of the reporting of child trafficking and abuse all over the world now. That's directly because of the campaign we started over 20 years ago. So it shows, brothers and sisters, we can have an impact. But each of our individual actions is simply steam without an engine. It's dissipated unless we organize. The oral interviews you're going to hear today, the oral histories we're going to hear in a few minutes from these rebels over the last number of years, they set a shining example of what to do individually. But we need more than individual action. We need to create a counterculture that can draw the masses of people away out of the existing system into a new system under the common law based on natural law's three principles. No one has any natural authority over anyone else. No one has a right to anything more than anyone else on the earth. And we are put here to live in harmony and peace with each other. Those three principles of natural law. And going into today's show, we're reminded that the Russian Revolution of 100 years ago, or the Protestant Reformation of 500 years ago this week, it's not a coincidence they happened at the same time of year, because those were acts of liberation. Some say from the hand of God, some say from the people. The reality is we took it within our own hands to end a corrupt system and create something new and better for a time. So with that in mind, I want to go to a news item, and this is really quite funny. I saw it the other day over the internet. It was posted actually November 3rd, and it states, ruling draws line on religious freedoms. Now, this is a case by the Supreme Court of Canada that said, a big ski resort development in southeastern British Columbia can go ahead, despite a claim by a native group that the development violates their sacred land. The decision, now this is really important, it shows you how the system shoots itself in its foot. The decision clarifies a boundary in the charter concerning religion, and it establishes that the government does not have a duty to protect an object of religious belief. These native people said that in Jumbo Valley, it was a traditionally sacred area, and of course the Supreme Court justices, never wanting to stand on the side of natives, sided with the ski resort development. They said, yeah, you can have your right to religious freedom, but we're not going to guarantee your place of religious practice. So to quote the legal decision, the Charter protects, this is the Charter of Rights and Freedom in Canada, the Charter protects the freedom to worship, but does not protect the spiritual focal point of worship. That means, folks, there's no inherent right of protection over a place of worship. Well, isn't this good news? Because the Catholic, Anglican, and United churches that are convicted criminal bodies guilty of genocide of Native people, the Supreme Court of Canada has now said their church structures, their property, and their buildings are not inherently protected. That means we can enact our common law warrants, folks, and go and occupy and seize those churches, and the government will not have a problem with that, because the Supreme Court of Canada doesn't have a problem with it. And they thought they were simply coming down on the side of a ski resort. In fact, they were coming down against their own buddies in crime, the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches of Canada, that killed over 60,000 Native children. And under international law, their property and authority are now forfeit. So there you have it, folks. Those of you who were hesitant about occupying churches, opening them up as daycares, they're publicly tax-supported properties anyway, so why shouldn't they be opened up by we the people? You can now legally seize those churches, and the Supreme Court of Canada will not have a problem with it, because they said there's no inherent right to those properties. Thank you, Supreme Court of Canada, for being on the side of the people for once. If you have any comments on that, write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. And moving right along, we want to, just in a few minutes, we're going to bring on that the oral history tape. It'll run for about a half hour, and then we'll be on after that. But one of the things we also want to point out is this bugaboo of anarchism. You're going to hear the word anarchism today, and I want to address that briefly. Just it's like the word communism. It's used to get people upset. It's used to get people afraid of the very thing that's going to liberate us. And I want to read something from it. It's a wonderful courtroom speech. One of my fans, one of my great buddies, Clarence Darrow, he was a lawyer who fought for the rights of the underdog for many years in America. And he was asked to support a group of communists in America. All they did is they raised a red flag and they had a protest march. And they were thrown in jail for it. Now, listen to Clarence Darrow's words. "Before you gentlemen of the jury allow yourselves to be scared into condemning my clients, and I mean by that, scared with a bugaboo by words like communism and anarchy, let me ask you to consider the substance of those words. My clients didn't invent communism, nor did Vladimir Lenin or Karl Marx. For communism is not a word, but a spirit on the wind that has been with humanity ever since the first laborer was forced to toil in misery and oppression for a landlord or a king or some other idle drone. Communism is the common spirit of humanity, of the understanding born into every human heart that the world belongs to all of the people and not to those who have murdered or stolen their way into riches and into power over others. And to something from our hearts, its symbol is the color of our blood, the common red blood that courses through every living man and woman. My clients stand charged with hoisting a red flag and proclaiming the brotherhood of workers across the world. Well, what is wrong with that? Did not the same spirit of equality inflame our patriots of 1776 and give birth to our republic? Was not the same vision of justice in the hearts of our founding fathers when they declared that all men are created equal? And yet this red flag outrages the rich men and their paid reporters and politicians, as well as should, for it symbolizes the ending of their tyranny over mankind. For the red flag flew at Bunker Hill as well as in Russia during their own revolution, and it's been present wherever honest men fight for their liberties. It is the common flag of rebels everywhere. You men of the jury are mostly working men yourselves, and you should give thanks for rebels like my clients. For none of the rights and benefits you enjoy today would exist if it were not for rebels like these. Every right ever won from the rulers has been achieved through the suffering and the blood of those rebels who have proclaimed that there are but two nations in this world, those who work and those who live off that work. For you, the workers, are the majority. Not a wheel would turn without your labor. And yet how easily down the centuries have the parasites who live off your labor set you against each other, one worker fighting against another, putting guns in your hands to kill each other in wars, or placing you in juries to try and condemn the honest rebels who will not rest comfortably alongside lies and wrong. But beneath those barriers that divide and kill you working people, you remain united by the common red blood of humanity, and one day it will break free as a single, irresistible flood and return the world and its wealth to all of you, the people, who nowadays fight and die for the scraps tossed to you from the tables of the rich, tables that are crammed with the bounty of the earth stolen from all of you. And so I say to you, good gentlemen of the jury, that if you condemn my clients for trying to create a new world of equality and freedom, if you give way to the fear and hysteria generated by the wealthy to divide and conquer we the people, then you will be cutting your own throats." And those were the words of Clarence Darrow, 1921, in his trial in defense of the members of the Communist Labor Party for so-called sedition. Now, just before we listen to these oral histories, let me remind you folks that when I say communism, I am not talking about Joe Stalin and labor camps and the murder of 20 million people during the 1930s in Russia. Communism has nothing to do with Stalinism or the dictatorships created in its name. And we're going to get into that after the interview. I want to clarify that a bit more about what I mean by that and how we have to stand on the living tradition and not the words and the dictatorships created. It's no more true that Stalinism represented communism than the Pope represents Jesus Christ. These are false and artificial dictatorships created on a very good idea. And that's my word on that for now. Now, I'm going to ask my brother Don if he could now play our tape. It's called, the tape is actually called Older is Bolder, an interview with rebels and anarchists. We'll be back after this.
exploitation, those who would take they must give.
To me, anarchy is a way of life. I think that anarchy is not a noun, but an adjective, which describes the tension that has always existed between moral autonomy and political authority, especially in the area of combinations, whether they're to be voluntary or coercive. The way I tell my friends, say, what can you expect from me? You can expect me to be trustworthy, not to take you for a ride, not to endlessly seek advantages, to do my share of the work of the world, to put back as much as I can, to take out only what I need, and to try not to hurt you or hurt anybody else. If I can expect that from you, from all of you, then between us, as self-governing people who don't need a cop to tell us what to do, we can start building voluntary combinations and get the work of the world done without the boss and without the state. That's it.
My acquaintance with anarchists has been very forceful in shaping my own way of life, because I learned very early that you don't have to wait for the revolution to be an anarchist, that anarchy is something you can live. I decided not to be competitive, but to favor the cooperative side of my personality. Because anarchy is a word used to instill fear and terror in people, it was a relief to hear people introduce themselves as communal, individual, communist anarchists to describe themselves. They didn't follow any hierarchical organization. They wanted their right to express themselves as individuals, a right to consensus in decision making and decisions for which they would be individually responsible.
I grew up in a socialist family rather than an anarchist family. My parents were old Finnish immigrants, Socialist Party. They were in the labor movement a long time. But my father was something of a rebel. He never took to any kind of bureaucracy. And he was an active union member, farmer, cooperator. Had a cousin who was radical, an activist in the working class movement. She organized unions, strikers, she fought abortion rights back in the 20s and 30s. And she also was a heroine of mine, and she reminds me very much of how I conceive Emma as having been.
World War II saw me as an anarchist pacifist, meeting with other anarchists who were anti-war. We had discussion group going, we published a newspaper, and were turned on to what anarchism might mean. We were opened up to another whole world, the world of A.S. Neal and his new educational ideas, Paul Goodman and his anarchist millenarian ideas, Wilhelm Reich in his anti-nuclear family ideas. And they were all very important in our viewing ourselves as anarchists. When World War II ended, my spouse and I, who were living together, had not gotten married, despite my mother and father's opinion, I said, Ma, you were never married. Why do you think I should be married? She said, things were different that time, she says. Free love was very popular when Emma Goldman was around. It is not popular, so popular anymore. And I said, I'll always remember what you told me when I was a little kid. And I asked you, why didn't you wear a wedding ring? And you said, Papa and I love each other, and we don't have to have a license like dogs do to be together. And that made a really profound impression on me.
When I was 12, we had to write a paper. First paper I ever wrote. I wrote it on cooperatives. Now, I don't know why I thought of cooperatives, but I did. I was a person who, even then, who believed in cooperation. I didn't believe in competition. This meant that somehow I understood that competition wasn't great. And through my life, I had problems in school because I just didn't like to compete. Now, I didn't realize I was an anarchist. I didn't know what anarchism was, even though I lived in Brooklyn, which was a hotbed of anarchism. I had no idea. When I came to California, I met several people who called themselves anarchists, and when we talked about it, they felt just as I did. It was a new experience because, well, I guess feminism helped me experience my being as a woman. Anarchism helped me experience my being as a human being. And that's why I'm very happy I found anarchism.
Let's talk about violence and anarchy. The appellation violent has been applied to anarchists ever since the Haymarket. When somebody threw a bomb, some people were killed, four anarchists were executed, and we were everlastingly labeled by the press as being bomb throwers. We've always had to deal with that label. And that's all it is. It's the pot calling the kettle black. Exactly that. Nothing more, nothing less. Who has all the guns? You know, who has the hydrogen bomb? When a shop closes in Dayton, Ohio, and the plant runs away, when a steel mill closes in Detroit, it's used three generations of workers. It's incredibly violent, the impact on people's lives. When anarchism is characterized as violent and chaotic, what in fact is being described is this rotten capitalist system which runs you from pillar to post. You never know where it's going to jump or what it's going to do. It creates wars, pestilence, depressions, agony in people's lives, the agony in the earth itself.
My spouse and I were tired of living in the shuffle of New York City. We were in correspondence with people who had been conscientious objectors in the West Coast. They were anarchists. San Francisco was the hotbed of culture and anarchy or something like that. Sex and anarchy is an article in Harper's had put it. And we decided to see what the West Coast had. And we came out here and loved the environment and decided this was a place for community. We lived in a community house in the city. It was an open place, predating the kind of flower children era later on. This was 1948. We met up with people who were involved in the beginnings of KPFA. Denny Wiltshire, who was doing the public forum programming, was very much interested in our ideas of anarchism and education.
Little kids, that's where it starts. Now you take your kids, and when they're 5, 6 years old, on a given day in September, you abandon them to authorities and institutions over which they have no control. That's dumb.
I recently came back from a very rewarding experience. I was a volunteer worker in a refugee camp in Harlingen, Texas. The idea in the camp was to motivate the people to control their own lives. It was a great pleasure to learn that the director of the camp and the person who owned the property were anarchists. And the camp was run on anarchist principles, which simply meant that instead of a director doing the planning and assigning the jobs, the refugees did the planning, and the refugees determined who would do the work, who would do the cooking, who would do the cleanup, and how the camp would be run. People started to embroider, to make hammocks, to do artwork, to use their time in a profitable way. It not only involved doing the shit work, but also being sure that all the people were living up to their responsibilities. It became an exercise in cooperation. It became anarchy at work. And it also empowered the people to determine how they would run their lives. And it gave them a very remarkable introduction to life in the United States.
We who thought we knew what anarchy was about had to step aside and let the refugees experience taking control of their own lives and then being responsible for them so they could come back and evaluate them.
It also gave us an opportunity to work as staff, to work with the refugees, to show them how anarchy could operate.
So good part of my life I would consider myself a libertarian socialist, really a closet anarchist, and finally I declared myself an anarchist without qualification. I also became a wobbly quite a few years ago in the IWW, and that represented an anarcho-syndicalist tradition to me. I felt that I had to have some left organization where I could hang my hat with, and the one that I felt comfortable with most was the wobbly, or anti-authoritarian, anti-bureaucratic, very democratic in their approach.
As I grew older, I had naturally to work in hierarchical situations, and they weren't very promising or very pleasing. Luckily, after I divorced, my children were grown up, I found Modern Times Bookstore, and here I am in a non-hierarchical setting, and it's been wonderful. Modern Times is not an anarchist bookstore, but it is a collective bookstore. It follows collective principles. Each of the people gets the same amount of money per day, and we all make decisions consensually. Basically, those are anarchist principles. All the people have equal power, and the power resides in the collective, not in any one person. So there's no boss. That's what makes it so nice to work here. If we want to make a little more money, we talk about it and we figure out if we can afford it and we add some money to our salaries. If we want to carry a certain book, we talk about it. So it's a very different situation from all of the work situations I've ever had. It most closely resembles an anarchist situation than anybody I've ever been in. Anyway, it gives me a sense that what I feel is important, what I want is important. It's not that I have to please the boss. I have to please myself and my fellow workers. But I want to do that anyway. It just resembles what I conceive of as an anarchist situation. What we hope someday will exist all over.
David and I remained together and decided to have children too. My experience in the cooperative nursery school movement was really very important for me, because in the early 50s, the ideas of preschool child rearing were really libertarian, and there was full acknowledgement of individual growth and development, of a non-authoritarian relationship between teachers and parents and children. That what I wanted to do with the rest of my life was to be involved in some kind of libertarian education. I went back to school to learn the techniques of teaching, was totally discouraged about the institution of public education. State schools, whether they be in the United States, Russia, Japan, China, anywhere, the purpose of education is to indoctrinate its students to be good citizens of their country, to be patriotic, to be a good citizen of the national state. The very antithesis of anarchist ideas. I would not want to teach in the public school system.
Most of us, as we are abandoned to authorities and institutions over which we have no control, being sent to state-owned schools, for instance, when we're really little, wind up unable to form voluntary combinations. We wind up part of coercive combinations, hierarchical combinations, whether they're marital, boss-employee, military, what have you. All we ever wanted to do as people was to be able to form voluntary combinations.
I was in the printing trades unions, the National Typographical Union, which recently merged into the Communications Workers Union. I was always considered a rabble-rouser, a militant, a shit kicker, as some people would call it. In the union, bureaucrats never quite liked me or thought too much of me because I was always in their hair. I mean, any time there was some attempt to squash democracy in the union, even to the elementary point of not allowing things to be posted on a bulletin board or parliamentary maneuvers at union meetings, I was always one of the first to raise my voice in protest. We have free speech in this union, as the labor is all about. The wobbly in me spoke at all these times, too.
Let's deal with violence and anarchy in three ways. First, personal violence. Ammon Hennessy, the great Catholic anarchist, was sent as a troubleshooting welfare worker in Minneapolis to deal with a guy chiseling mattresses from welfare and selling them to the poor. Ammon's a little guy. He fellow walked all around the table, big guy. with a butcher knife in his hand. Finally stuck it in the table in front of Ammon. The fella came over to take a swing at him. Ammon reached out and shook his hand for about a minute. The guy looked at him and said, "What did you do?" Ammon said, "Look at your big hairy fist. That's your toughest weapon. My strongest weapon is I got moral courage. And that's your weakest weapon because you haven't got any. I'm going to use my strongest against your weakest." And I won, didn't I? The man can escalate all the way from a cop on the beat with a handgun up to a hydrogen bomb. And he begs you to walk up that road with him. Sticks his chin out, say, "Plant one there, you know, make my day." What really frightens him, you want the cops to show up? Put a big banner up that says peace. They'll show up with face shields and batons, because that's what threatens them. Their game is violence. This state is an incredibly violent thing. We live in a climate of violence, capitalism and the state. We're trying to get out of it. We have to get away from that. The violence of property. I, as a white man, was born armed to the teeth with an arsenal of privileges. Racial privilege, economic privilege, sexual privilege. That architecture of privilege is grounded in property. Our feelings about the ownership of people and our ownership of things. Unless we can overcome that disease, the ownership, mine and yours, we're going to be violent toward each other. If you must have yours and I must have mine, no matter how cordial our relationship, we're secretly armed against each other. And possession is detention that we must eliminate, get rid of that. A good example, I have a car. If somebody stole my car, by the fact of ownership, I commit myself, if somebody steals it, to calling the police to get it back. But in a hot pursuit, whoever stole it could get killed. I commit myself, by the fact of ownership, to all of the state's violence, unless I'm willing just to write it off. The solution to that is to deal with possession of people and things. Less and less and less until we have nothing and gain all. The third kind of violence, and that's the trashing of property. That has a real salutary effect on your psyche. But it was for the Wobblies years ago coined the phrase the workers' superstitious reverence for property. It's the American Property Party with its Republican and Democratic wings. In a propertarian society, we're raised through those institutions that we're abandoned to with the respect for private property, irrespective of whose it is. Okay. When we can educate people as to what is authentically ours and what is not ours, what has been stolen from us, we only wind up hurting each other. Violence is down for three counts and knocked out. It's only going to make enemies out of people that ought to be our friends.
I was able to see community development among refugees from El Salvador who lived in three different camps in Honduras. It was an opportunity to see a form of anarchism, a form of running a person's life that was not hierarchical, but that took into fact that as individuals they would not survive, as a community they could share their skills, teach one another, and hold on to their faith in the future. The children were responsible for part of the work. Their day was devoted to learning a task, to education. Adults also went to school in the workshops where they make everything that they wear. They make their own furniture, and they make their own cooking utensils. They have a machine shop where men as well as women learn how to repair small motors, how to keep the cars that service the camp functioning. All this has evolved through a non-hierarchical program where people take responsibility. The structure is not oppressive. They have this inner peace, an inner comfort, an inner determination to survive.
Had our own children. We were trying to raise them in a non-authoritarian way. We wanted the best for our immediate families, and we started a school called Walden because we realized that the unifying ideas of civil disobedience, the interest in nature, and natural sciences versus the highly developed technocratic world we lived in were very important to us. And we just took our kids and we started teaching them, and it was wonderful. We believed in a school that did not proselytize, but would make all points of view available. If you raise people this way, if you give them the tools of thinking independently and of attempting to understand what was going on politically, is a way of looking at life. Again, the school was not to make anarchists. in the heyday of meaningful schools, meaningful education, Walden was considered by everybody as in the forefront of advanced education, and kids came like crazy to see how we were doing this libertarian school, and it felt important. The first year was 1958. Founders are all gone. We're not teaching anymore, and we don't have much input in the policy of the school. The school is basically a teachers' cooperative, but it's still a place where decisions are made as by a community of people who agree consensually. My grandchild goes there, as does another grandchild of one of the founding group, and it's an exciting place for children.
I was very proud to be a very active part of the movement during the Vietnam War, when we, in our typographical union, and trying to get the union to take a stand against the Vietnam War. We were threatened by some of the more pro-war members of the union. We did succeed. Finally, we got our union to go on marches against the Vietnam War. We considered one of our great achievements when labor was supposed to be hard hat, George Meany pro-Vietnam. I'm 61 years old now, so I don't think I'll be called upon to be drafted, but if we'd have to stand up against the boss class, the capitalists, or state bureaucrats who want to impose themselves, I'd be proud to be in the ranks.
During the 60s, it seemed to me that people were really understanding what anarchism was all about, especially with all those communes. They were really experimenting with anarchistic kind of life. Collective living and collective work. The people were very young, and so they didn't have much patience, and they gave up during the 70s. But it was a wonderful experiment because people saw that it might be able to work for people to have collective living situations and collective work situations. The living situation these days is certainly not like it was in the 60s with all those communes. But people have a memory of it, and maybe if things get bad enough, they'll go back to that.
My greatest teachers have been the senior partners in the firm, the IWW. The long memory is the most radical idea in America. Yeah. You know, that's why they don't teach it. You know, you've got to go to your elders to get it.
It's a tribute to Mel Most, WBAI's first station manager in 1960 under the aegis of Pacifica. Mel died in his sleep, which probably pushing 80, I would guess. He was a great guy. He was, in fact, a very direct descendant of the famous Johann Most, the associate of Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman. I knew Mel as an anarchist organizer. He was one of the founding members of the Libertarian Book Club. He was also a lifetime IWW organizer, the Wobblies. And just before he died, he had been getting very active again in organizing. Mel was always active. He always had something going. But he'd been sick last year, or his health wasn't all that good. And when he came out of the hospital, he was using one of those aluminum walkers. He'd been pretty shaky and not up to much. But it seemed like he was getting his 30th wind and getting right back in stride as an organizer and doing more than ever. And in the last couple of weeks before he died, he did a number of things. He's founded a new group called the Humanarchist Front, a combination of humanism and anarchism. And he also organized an IWW job branch in New York for artists and writers, which was the Living Theater, formerly run by Julian Beck and Judith Molina. Mel had been a friend of Julian's and Judith's for a long, long time. And in this renaissance of activity, this late springtime of activity in Mel's life, he thought of them as the first artists in New York that he wanted to organize into the IWW. Last time I had saw him was at Esther Dolgoff's funeral, Sam Dolgoff's lifetime companion, who died just a few weeks before Mel. And Mel was the chairman of that event. I mean, that shows how busy and active he was. He was also, incidentally, for a number of years involved in prostitutes organizing. He was an expert on the social aspects of prostitution and very much a spokesman for the Prostitutes Union and other similar organizations. Of course, he'd been in San Francisco at the big Continental Anarchist Gathering. He was trying to organize people to do an old-fashioned IWW soapbox event. He was going to put up a box and try to have a 24-hour ranting going on at it. Mel was one of the handful of old people who were at that event, and the rest of the 3,500 people who were there were quite young. Mel was always very popular with young people and very good at organizing them, and even went to the extent of preferring young people to a lot of the older people. The reasons are obvious. If you get to be 75 years old and your soul is still on fire, most of the people that you know have burnt out or died, then naturally you're going to prefer strong, idealistic young people to your own contemporaries. And that's really sort of the way Mel was. He always discovered the energy level of the young. And was one of those older generation anarchists who very consciously set out to make himself a link between the past and the future by always speaking with young people and recruiting them.
Now, these Wildlies, I guess, got some street speaking going on Tuesday. We even got a whole set of guidelines about how to do street speaking. I was kind of keen. And I want the IWWs and everybody else of that persuasion to get down there and try to take your hand at soapboxing. I'll get my chops in now, okay? Listen to those old soapboxers like Phil Melman, you know, that I soapboxed with here in San Francisco 15, 20 years ago. But those guys talked in shorthand. They didn't waste any breath. I say, fellow workers, we are going to organize as a class. The working classes are going to organize as a class. What is the working class, fellow workers? The working class is anybody who has a boss and works for wages. It doesn't matter if you're a college professor or a ditch digger. If you've got a boss and you're working for wages, you're in the working class, you better be proud of it. Why, the middle class is just a joke made up by the bosses to keep us fighting against each other. All right, we're going to organize as a class. We're going to organize into one big union. One big union. We're going to have a general strike. General strike will last about half an hour. Then we're going to take this sock full of puppy shit they call a culture apart and put it together so it makes more sense. With the means of production in the hands of the producers, production for use instead of profit, create abundance for workers and nothing for parasites. Thank you. Oh, I have led a good life full of peace and quiet. I shall have an old age full of rum and riot. I have been a good lad, careful and artistic. I shall have an old age coarse and anarchistic. Once I paid my taxes and followed every rule, banker, boss, and bureaucrat thought me a willing tool. I voted Democratic and paid the church its due. Now all those swine will have to find some other chump to screw. Of interest, banks, and credit, insurance, tax, and rent, of lawyers, agents, generals, and clerics, I repent. With this for corporations and scorn for those elected, oh, I will be an old bum, loved but unrespected.
That was Utah Phillips, Ruth Sheridan, Harry Sitonen, Mel Most, Jean Pauline, and Audrey Goodfriend, six rebels. And we walk in their footsteps, all of us who struggle on. By the way, this show is especially going out to my good anarchist buddy, Larry Gamboni, living over there in Nanaimo. I knew Larry back in, 40 years ago now or more, when I was first getting involved in radical politics, libertarian politics. Larry's in his 70s now, and he's suffering. He's got an illness, and where all our prayers go out for Larry. So, Larry, this show is for you today, and all our anarchist brothers and sisters. Now, one thing I want to say to folks in the last 10 minutes or so, I want to do a clarification, because I've had a number of emails coming in saying, you don't support Stalinist tyranny, do you, Kevin? I didn't think you were like that. Well, here we go, folks. I got a quote that kind of sums things up from my point of view of what actually happened. We want to clear the air a little bit on this. Words of a guy called Leon Trotsky, who was killed by Stalin for being a genuine revolutionary. Here's what Trotsky said about what happened to all the people in Russia in the 1930s, that mass genocide of the peasants under Stalin. Quote, the forced collectivization of the Russian peasantry was the antithesis of true socialism, which relies not on coercion from above, but the conscious and willing assertion of both peasant and worker over the conditions of their lives. Stalin's extermination of millions of kulaks and their families was the expression not of a socialist regime, but the requirements of his own personal dictatorship. The brutality that wiped out the individual peasant producers during the 1930s was simply an extension of the reign of terror Stalin had launched against the old Bolsheviks and both the right and the left oppositions within the communist movement years before the collectivization drive was commenced. Stalin was as afraid of the true communist as he was of the kulak, and wiped out both to ensure his personal ascendancy alongside the establishment of a modern industrial economy. Thus did the dictator achieve in the East, in a single decade, what required centuries for an emergent capitalist class to accomplish in the West, and with no less human suffering and slaughter, namely the concentration of capital in the hands of a new exploiting class. This was not communism, this was Stalinism. Leon Trotsky said that in 1940, about 6 months before he himself was assassinated by Stalin's agent in Mexico City. Now, that's the whole point, folks. Nothing happened in Russia in the 1930s that didn't happen in the West over centuries. The thing about Russia is that the forcing of people off their land, like happened in England with the enclosures, the slave trade, the Industrial Revolution, genocide around the world, colonialism, all of that same thing happened externally in the West, but the same thing happened in Russia internally. It wasn't an external colonialism and genocide, it was an internal one aimed at the peasants to achieve the same thing that's happened in the West, the Industrial Revolution, but it happened in a telescope period of time, and so it's more obvious. Not excusing it, but I'm saying it's the same process in the West or in the East. Same thing in Canada with the genocide of Native people. Doesn't seem like genocide because it happened over 300 years, and no one generation can see what's going on. But when you look at the whole pattern, it's the same oppression over people in the hands of an elite. We're against all elites, whether you call themselves capitalists, whether they call themselves communists. We don't believe in state authority or corporate authority or religious authority. We believe in we the people. That's my anarcho-communism, if you like, just so we clarify that point. Now, another thing is when we're talking about what to do. Now, these folks have given a brilliant witness about what you do individually. But, you know, a lot of you listening out there are on your own. You feel like you're on your own. You're struggling on your own in a small town normally, because a lot of our listeners are not living in the big city. They're living in smaller communities. Everyone around you seems conservative. You don't know what to do to just fight at the simplest level of defending your children or your community against this encroaching corporate autocracy that's everywhere now. There's no responsible government anymore. There's no accountable system at all. We know what we live under. And how do you fight back? You're the steam without an engine, without a piston. Well, there's a few things that can help you, and I keep going back to this all the time, folks. We have a manual for whistleblowers and hellraisers, Truth Teller Shield. Just put in the name Kevin Annett at Amazon.com, and it'll come up. Let me read you something from it, page 38 on the manual for freedom fighters. Social movements reflect the limitations of their weakest elements and are impeded by the lowest common denominator factor of democracy, that your group can move only as fast and as far as the least aware and engaged person in your ranks. That kind of restriction is fatal under the conditions of war, because as Sun Tzu says in The Art of War, whoever depends on a majority for victory has to reflect its weakest aspects and must therefore be defeated. Only veterans are capable of victorious combat. By leading the inexperienced or wavering mass in their wake, the leadership of this vanguard of veterans is the key to victory in any battle. Now, that's a really important point. We're not out there to reach the majority. And, you know, so many times talking to folks, and I had a conversation the other night with somebody where they say, yeah, but look at how apathetic everybody is. Look at the sheep out there. No, do not look at the sheep out there. That's the 85% who are going to have to be dragged along. Look at the 5 to 10% out there who are waking up. That's the vanguard, the elite, the remnant, if you like. They're not an elite, but they're a remnant. There are a few people put aside who are more aware. It's in any group, the ones who will not give up, the ones who keep fighting, who are aware, who will not go along with this corporatocracy, whose reality is not reduced to 2 inches of an iPad anymore, who are rooted in reality. Those are the ones we have to reach. And those are the ones we have to organize. So this show is designed to organize towards those kind of people. It's reaching out to those folks, those men and women who need that organization. So what we say to you now is see yourself as a remnant and join up. Write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. Get on board with this because we are active all over. And in that sense, a couple of announcements. There's groups organizing in Canada, and the three cities especially, Vancouver, British Columbia, Kelowna, British Columbia, and London, Ontario. In those three centers, there are people that are actively organizing common law action groups. Now, there's people in other communities, but I mention those three because they're a bigger net to draw on. There's greater numbers of people in those areas who can potentially join our groups. But by these communal action groups, we're talking about groups of 1 to 3 people who take action immediately in their community. They're the basis, the seed of something much bigger. But we find, for example, that if you try to organize on too big a scale, you get targeted very quickly for infiltration and destruction. The state is adept at doing that, of targeting big groups. No, we operate in small ways, small action teams that go in and hit targets like vulnerable church properties, which, don't forget, the Supreme Court of Canada said you can now seize without any legal consequence because there's no guaranteed right of church property anymore in Canada, which is a good thing because these are genocidal churches. So take those actions against these criminal bodies, but do it in a way where you strike in a small number and then fade back into the night like any true anarchist. Because don't forget, what does anarchy mean? Break down the word. Anarchos means no authority. Archos, Greek word, the archon, it means the, in the Bible, that meant principality and power, the hidden spiritual powers that really control everything. The ones behind the scenes, it's like the elites you never hear about, the guys really pulling the strings, whether in heaven or on earth. It's those principalities and powers called the archons. Well, Jesus was somebody who said no authority but God, which is found within ourselves. The kingdom of heaven is within you. That's what Annie Wobbly always said. Any organizer for a revolution says, the authority is among we the people and only the people. Sovereignty begins with us and ends with us. It's not given away by a vote or a petition or paying taxes. You can take back your sovereignty at any point. That's what anarchos or anarchy means. So we got to de-learn these terms and take back our authority. So the other announcement I want to make, too, is that in upcoming shows, people have requested more workshops, more practical experiences for people on the ground. So we're going to do that. And if you've heard anything today you don't agree with, if you think I'm full of shit or anything you've said is bullshit, then call up. Write to thecommonland@gmail.com. Come on the air. We'll have a debate. That's what free speech is all about, extending the realm of imagination and possibility and thought outside these stupid one-dimensional barriers that are continually being placed upon us. Get your kids out of the school system. Stop paying taxes. Keep the money in the local community. Take direct action to reclaim the earth for all of us. That's what we're all about here, folks. And I remind you, ITCCS.org. That's part of the living memory of that tribunal that was set up in 2010 to prosecute the genocidal churches. And we succeeded. We forced 4 top Catholic officials, including Pope Benedict, to step down. The power is in our hands, brothers and sisters. ITCCS.org. And for you folks in Canada who want the proof of the genocide by these churches, go to murderbydecree.com. Murderbydecree.com. Order our books, including Murder by Decree. Get it into the libraries and the schools. Teach the next generation about the crimes that they're helping to pay for. Their parents are paying for these crimes with their blood-soaked tax money. No more tax exemptions for these churches. These are all part of our campaign that we are leading as we speak. So again, in closing, brothers and sisters, take the power into your own hands and take action now. If you're the remnant, if you're that 10 or 15% out there who get it, who jive with what we're saying today, and who want to take action, then write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. And 7 books we've written in the last 18 months all address this. Murder by Decree, the Crime of Genocide in Canada. Fallen, the Story of the Vancouver Four. 1497 and so on, A History of White People in Canada. Establishing the Reign of Natural Liberty, a Common Law Training Manual. Here We Stand, Summoning God's People in the Time of Judgment. A Manual for Whistleblowers, a Truth Teller's Manual. And Unrelenting, From Sodom to Zion. Those books tell the story and lead on the struggle as we speak. So I want to thank you for tuning in today, friends. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle's Strong Voice, coming to you from planet Earth. And I want you to tune in regularly and carry this on. The power is in your hands, brothers and sisters. Now we're going to leave with the words of Martin Luther King, shortly before he died, taking us all to the mountaintop. Until then, continue to be inspired, brothers and sisters. Until next week, stay strong, stay clear. Here's Brother Martin.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say, we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow.